counter-revolution had collapsed, the interventionists were dispersed, and Soviet Russia was at last, and for the first time, on its own. In those fantastic days of 1920, the sun seemed to have risen at last, and the millennium was at hand. The infant experiment in the Soviet principle had taken on the giants of the world and held them, and challenged them, and beaten them. Here was the apotheosis of the career of Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, the prophet Lenin, the student and jailbird and exile and teacher and conspirator and doctrinaire of the century's most extreme philosophy, supreme at last. But over what? A nation torn and destroyed and almost demolished, a country reduced to scratching for existence among the debris of a fearsome and brutal war. 3 years had been lost, or stolen. Lenin and the Soviets had been handed back a ravaged and derelict land, its industries beaten and broken to a standstill, its resources reduced to rubble, the very face of the country scarred and distorted, set back a decade. The nation's communications were almost totally broken to bits in a vast country where they'd never been adequate and now destroyed. This was the problem for Lenin. This was the post-revolutionary problem, for which none of the political revelations of Marx, or indeed of Lenin, had provided. This problem, at least, could not be solved by words, however skillful, however orthodox. Russia was now a land of refugees, 3 million people without a roof, freed from capitalism, and at the same time from everything else, depending now on a socialist state very nearly as desperate as they themselves. It created what almost all revolutions create, the new community of the dispossessed. The Soviet state was born to the sound of funeral orations. One by one, the old comrades of the revolution were seen into the ground. The coffins were painted red. There were no priests and no prayers. Innumerable men and women were committed to the Russian earth. Lenin buried them all. Thousands upon thousands had died at the hands of those who opposed the revolution and of those who made it. There's no birth, they say, without pain. Sometimes in those ruinous days, it must have seemed to Vladimir Ilyich that the price had been woefully high. There was, of course, a time and a place for symbolism, for the ceremonial laying of stones. Even revolutionary Russia places much value on ritual. Lenin could find time to inscribe plaques and formally consecrate them to communism. But there was so much more to be done. In the military field, said Lenin, we've won a complete victory. Now we must prepare for an even more difficult victory. The nation had virtually to be rebuilt, almost from the foundations, and almost the only machine in all the country to help was an inheritance of the war. There may have been some ironic symbolism as a byproduct, but the only thing that worked in Russia was a captured British tank. Lenin spoke endlessly throughout it all, exhorting, insisting, demanding, arguing. It may have been rhetoric. Perhaps none of the Russians had any choice. The fact is that somehow or other this terrible job was done. The broken bones of the country were knit together with nothing except hands and feet and muscles and endurance, the simple hard technology of inexhaustible manpower. Life crept back to a semblance of normal, the elementary processes of peasant economy. The Smolensky market was in business again. It wasn't much, but it was something. It was now the end of isolation. The first Soviet state was gradually becoming the focus of one world attitude, at least. At the Congress of the Communist International in Moscow, the delegates from 39 countries debated the program by which they were to overcome the world. They and the Bolshevik pioneers, Radek, Zinoviev, Lunacharsky, Litvinov, the old guard and the new, including the American John Reed, journalist and historian of his times. Inside, they made their own history. Marx's old friend Clara Zetkin. On her right, the Japanese communist Sen Yatayama. On her left, Zinoviev. Then Smerov, leader of the Czechs. At the hub, always, Lenin projected his non-stop combination of magnetism and charm and petulant authority with that characteristic thrusting gesture of the shoulders and the chin, the dominating oratory of a man who said everything so often that it merely remained to say it again and again. It was his manner, as with many a personally modest man of extravagant powers, to retreat, as they say, into the limelight. By crouching inconspicuously to write his notes in an obscure corner, he was assured of a maximum attention. Here was the apogee of Vladimir Ilyich, the summit of his tempestuous and uncompromising career. His sickness came quite suddenly. In 1922, his first stroke laid him low. He went to recover in a small estate in the village of Gorky. It was a hemorrhage of the brain, but it was not necessarily of great danger. He seemed to rally, and very soon he was talking as vigorously as ever, or nearly. He rested in Gorky with his wife, Krupskaya, relaxed with local children, was visited by the party's secretary general, the young Joseph Stalin. That year he seemed to recover, and hastened back to Moscow, to the Council of People's Commissars, to the Central Committee, to the Central Executive. To Lenin, it was hard to accept that the business of the Soviet could continue without it. But by the end of the year, in the bitter winter, the second stroke failed him once again. And once again, Krupskaya took him back to Gorky, to the snow-bound villa where, in the silence of paralysis, he was to come to an end. So, at 6:30 on the evening of January the 21st, 1924, in the 54th year of his tireless, tormented and triumphant life, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin died of a sclerosis of the brain. They took him back to Moscow, gripped in the ferocity of the numbing winter's cold. King, no emperor, no czar, perhaps no other human being was ever so saluted at his death. He'd been many things in his time, all to one compelling and obsessive end. Through him, many had lived who would otherwise have died. Many had died who would otherwise have lived. They set what was left of Lenin in the Red Square, and there, in body, he lies to this day. Of Vladimir Lenin, it was once said by Winston Churchill, the Russian people's worst misfortune was his birth. Their next worst, his death. One could admire the neatness of the paradox and wonder. The half century that separated that birth and that death transformed everything. But for what, neither we nor Russia have lived long enough to know.